Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point.
A vote for Judge Kavanaugh is also a vote to reject the ruthless and outrageous tactics of the Democrat Party. Mean obstructionists, mean resistors.
That's President Donald Trump at a West Virginia rally on Saturday, the same night he tweeted that he's not limiting the scope of the FBI's background investigation of Judge Brett Kavanaugh, writing, quote, "I want them to interview whoever they deem appropriate at their discretion." Well, that expansive mandate has not been embraced or confirmed by the White House counsel's office, and that frustrates Democrats. Here's Hawaii Democratic Senator Mazie Hirono on ABC's This Week.
To limit the FBI as to the scope and who they're going to question, that really, I wanted to use the word farce, but that's not the kind of investigation that all of us are expecting the FBI to conduct.
So there is much to discuss with the Kavanaugh nomination, and we've also got the midterms just over a month away, and a last-minute U.S.-Canada trade deal. So this hour on Point, top reporters open their notebooks and look at the week ahead in the news. Do you believe that the FBI investigation will shed any useful light on the allegations made against Brett Kavanaugh? Is a limited scope in this investigation the way to go? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook. We're at On Point Radio. Well, joining me today from New York is Caitlin Huey Burns, CBS News digital political reporter. We've got her reporting on the streaming network CBSN and CBSNews.com as well. So, Caitlin, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. With us today from Washington is Pierre Thomas, Chief Justice Correspondent for ABC News. Pierre, it's wonderful to have you.
Hi, Meghna. Great to be here.
And also with us today from Washington as well is Michael Warren, Senior Writer at the Weekly Standard. Michael, thanks so much for joining us. Great to have you.
Thanks for having me, Meghna.
Okay, so Pierre, let me just start with you first. I mean, it seems as if we're having a lot of conflicting reports about exactly the scope of the FBI investigation and who's putting, you know, who's writing the limits to that scope. What do we know so far?
Well, I think the first thing we have to explain to people is that this is not a criminal investigation.
Correct.
It's a background investigation. So that means that the FBI is serving as the conduit, if you will, and the White House is the client.
Mm-hmm.
The White House dictates what they want done. And from what we understand in our reporting, they want to focus on the allegations involving Dr. Blasey Ford and the allegations regarding Deborah Ramirez. So the FBI, we're told, yesterday began their interviews of Ms. Ramirez, and she gave them a list of names. And again, the question is, is the FBI allowed to pursue those names that she gave them, or do they have to go back to the White House and ask for their permission, if you will, to go forward?
I see. So, Michael Warren, I mean, do we know any more about what might happen in those events? Maybe we don't, because I'm still not fully clear on, you know, the New York Times is reporting that, as Pierre just said, that there will only be four people interviewed by the FBI. But on the other hand, over the weekend, we also heard Raj Shah from the White House press office saying, well, the Senate Republicans are the ones who put the limits on the investigation. So what do you make about where we are right now?
Well, I mean, this is sort of reveals the difficulties once the Democrats, I think, won a victory in getting the FBI to investigate this about where it does go. Because as Pierre says, it's not a criminal investigation. They are essentially working on behalf of the White House to do this. I think there is a big question about whether this will change anything with regard to where the facts come out on this. The Senate Judiciary Committee has subpoena power. It has the ability to essentially compel testimony from certain witnesses under penalty of perjury. And so it really has the same levels of power. This was the Republican argument and in fact, the argument that Brett Kavanaugh made last Thursday, which was that essentially the investigation could be happening by the Senate Judiciary Committee. Shifting it to the FBI in some ways kind of clouds a little bit of how the mechanics of how these questions questions are being asked, and I'm predicting that whatever it finds, actually nobody's going to be any happier on either side of this.
I'm going to guess that for once we're hearing a prediction that's going to be 100% true, Michael. I mean, I mean, Caitlin, pick up on Michael's thought. I don't personally see, from all the discussion we've had, all we've seen over the past week especially, you know, any outcome that makes either side, I'll put sides in quotes here, satisfied with the process.
Right. I agree. I think one thing to consider, and something important to consider about the FBI's role in all of this now, is that, you know, just to make the point that the FBI won't be making any decisions about Kavanaugh. They are going to conduct this background information, present this information to the White House and to investigators on the committee, and the committee will still make a decision about Kavanaugh. So you're going to have some people say, well, the background investigation wasn't enough. You'll have some people who will say, mostly Republicans, say, well, this is what Democrats wanted this whole time, and we did it, and now we can move on. I think we have to look at the political implications of this as well. Jeff Flake, in supporting the FBI investigation, limited it in scope so that it didn't take, you know, several more weeks and other things could come out. Republicans kind of want this to finish up so that they can move ahead with this nomination, and say that, you know, if nothing comes out of this investigation, that there has been some lifting of the cloud. So it gives them a little more closure, so to speak. Democrats are saying that, you know, there are lots of allegations coming out. Of course, a week, as we know, is an eternity in politics. There could be other allegations that come out. There could be new ways of thinking about this. So still, there will be a lot of questions about the scope and how it evolves.
Yeah. You know, I mean, so Democrats may be frustrated right now, but it was Chris Coons last week on Thursday who said very clearly that he was the Democrat, Chris Coons, who was calling for a 1 week pause, as he described it. That's what he was hoping for, a 1 week pause for some kind of investigation to happen. So, I mean, Pierre, if Democrats are feeling frustrated right now, they walked into this eyes wide open.
They did indeed. But let me just say one thing. It is a different scenario and a different set of circumstances when FBI agents show up and start asking you questions. That's the wild card in all of this. When they start talking to people, sometimes they tell them more than they would tell Senate investigators, obviously more than they would tell reporters. And again, much of this will center around those two incidents involving Dr. Ford and Ramirez. But the key question is, what kind of other details will they pick up? Will they pick up details that give us more insight into whether, for example, Judge Kavanaugh was a heavy drinker? Did he become belligerent? Did he become a different kind of person? If that kind of information is developed over the course of next week, it will be compared to what his testimony was on last Thursday.
Okay, so on that point, let me just play a bit of tape here. This is Democratic Senator Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota on CBS's Face the Nation yesterday, really asking the White House to allow the FBI to investigate Kavanaugh, the allegations around Kavanaugh, without restrictions.
I'm a former prosecutor. They have to have the ability to pursue the evidence. You look at background checks when either, whether it's the Obama White House, whether it's the Trump White House, yes, they can order a background check when they put a nomination in place. But they cannot say, oh, hey, only interview the people in their neighborhood on one side of the street, or only interview people from a certain period of their life. You let the men and women of the FBI, the professionals, do their jobs.
Michael Warren, I'm curious, do you think that the president, the White House, and Senate Republicans are taking a risk here by, I mean, if indeed they are the ones who are limiting the FBI's check here? Because, you know, right now we also have, for example, we have Elizabeth Razor, who's supposedly a former girlfriend of Mike Judge, saying she's willing to talk to the FBI about, you know, the Mike Judge that she knew from high school and, you know, things that he had allegedly told her about. you know, sexual incidences that he may have participated in high school. And we also now have Charles Luddington, a former Yale basketball player and friend of Kavanaugh's, putting out a statement saying, no, I repeatedly saw Kavanaugh get belligerently drunk, and I want to talk to the FBI too, but neither of these people seem to be on the list of those that the FBI is approaching.
I think the fear that Republicans have and the White House has is that an extended FBI investigation does kind of delve into these issues. What the Republicans are going to be arguing, and I think they have some weight to this, is that that doesn't particularly pertain to the events in question, the events, the accusations against Brett Kavanaugh that as of yet, and the Senate Judiciary Committee's outside counsel that they brought in, Rachel Mitchell, released a memo that the Senate Judiciary Committee released over the weekend that essentially said there are there is not even a preponderance of evidence to pursue a criminal investigation in Dr. Blasey Ford's accusation. And that doesn't mean that the nomination still can't go down, particularly if we found out more information. But I think it would actually behoove the White House for the FBI to pursue that question sort of unfettered, because as of now, as the information is now, and as Rachel Mitchell's memo outlines, there are holes, there are inconsistencies in Dr. Ford's testimony, and if you're looking at this in terms of credibility and believability, it seems to me that at this point, the truth might very well might set Republicans and Brett Kavanaugh free if they're only willing to let that happen. Right now, I think they risk looking like they've got their thumb on the scales for something they may not even need to put their thumbs on there for.
Right. And Caitlin, we've just got about 30 seconds here to go before the break, but I think Democrats would say they saw and heard holes and inconsistencies in Brett Kavanaugh's testimony on Thursday as well. And that's what needs investigation.
Absolutely. And in addition to that, questions have been raised about his temperament and whether he is, in fact, too partisan to serve on the court. So I think there are going to be questions that extend beyond just this event in question.
Well, Caitlin Huey Burns is with us today. She's CBS News digital political reporter. Pierre Thomas is with us. He's Chief Justice Correspondent for ABC News. And Michael Warren joins us as well. He's senior writer at the Weekly Standard. And we're looking at what is guaranteed to be another major week in the news. Do you have confidence in the FBI's current background check, background investigation into the allegations around Judge Brett Kavanaugh? We'll be right back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking with some top reporters about what to look ahead for in this week's news. Caitlin Huey Burns joins us. She's CBS News digital political reporter. Pierre Thomas is also with us, Chief Justice Correspondent for ABC News. And Michael Warren joins us too today. He's senior writer at the Weekly Standard. And of course, so much attention focused on the FBI's current background investigation into the allegations surrounding Judge Brett Kavanaugh. And we've got lots of comments here on our website, onpointradio.org. John in Amherst says, lying and allegations aside, is someone with Kavanaugh's demonstrated belligerence and bias capable of serving as a judge on any bench, let alone the Supreme Court? Well, in fact, this weekend, Republican Senator Jeff Flake of Arizona was asked about that on 60 Minutes. This was just yesterday. And here's what he described he saw in Brett Kavanaugh's temperament during Kavanaugh's testimony last week.
When I heard him, I heard someone who I hope I would sound like if I had been unjustly accused. And to see his family behind him, as Chris said, and it was anger. But if I were unjustly accused, that's how I would feel as well.
And the Chris there that Senator Flake referred to is Senator Chris Coons of Delaware, who was also interviewed by 60 Minutes. And correspondent Scott Pelley asked Coons about the claim or the assertion or the belief that parts of Kavanaugh's testimony and his demeanor in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee may have crossed a line.
I'm not at all surprised to hear that from other colleagues in the committee or on television. But I was really struck that I thought his anger got the best of him and he made a partisan argument that would have been best left to be made for his advocates and defenders on the committee.
Made you wonder about his suitability?
In my case, yes. It made me wonder about his suitability to serve on the bench.
That's Democratic Senator Chris Coons speaking on 60 Minutes there. And I keep making the same mistake. I keep saying Mike Judge, but I mean to say Mark Judge. And I apologize to everyone for that mistake here. Caitlin Huey Burns, let me just pick up with you because you were speaking to this point before the break here. I wonder, you know, all day on Thursday, Democrats focused on their call for an investigation. They got one. They got an investigation, you know, its current terms they may not like. But I'm wondering if you think they missed an opportunity here because, you know, many folks did look at, for example, that paragraph in Judge Kavanaugh's opening statement where he talks about a left-wing conspiracy. He talks about the Clintons and, you know, that perhaps some folks might say they should just simply point at that as evidence of what, you know, might be Judge Kavanaugh's suitability or lack of for the Supreme Court.
Right. I think that paragraph was particularly revealing for a lot of people watching because, remember, we're talking about this seat as the potential swing seat on the court from a conservative ideological perspective. But when Kavanaugh was talking about the Clintons and the left-wing conspiracy, I think it did raise questions about whether he would, in fact, be a partisan, a political type of person. And so I wouldn't be surprised if the conversation starts to evolve this week away from the events in question in the 1980s and more towards Kavanaugh's suitability for the court. The question, though, and the point that I would make is that, you know, a lot of lawmakers made their decisions about Kavanaugh even before these allegations surfaced. You had many Democrats come out as soon as Kavanaugh was nominated or shortly thereafter saying that they could not support him. And you had lots of Republicans really cheering him on. So there is a question of, you know, how much the events of that we learned last week, how much we learned this week, how much it will actually change minds. I think Republicans also are considering the idea that they have wanted to shape the makeup of the courts. That's been an organizing principle for them in election after election. And so they have to kind of weigh that against the allegations that they've already heard and against any new information that comes out this week that pertains to the events in question and also that pertain to Kavanaugh's personality and his fitness for the court. Yeah.
Well, Michael Warren, I mean, chime in here, because if, as Caitlin says, we do start hearing more Democrats talking about issues of temperament, will that argument hold any weight now? Because there has been so much emphasis placed on allowing the FBI to investigate.
Magna, I think if that's where the argument shifts, as Caitlin suggests it might, it suggests that Brett Kavanaugh is going to be confirmed as a Supreme Court to the Supreme Court. I mean, this is respectfully, I think, a canard that his testimony, his anger in that testimony on Thursday somehow revealed something about the kind of justice he would be. What we're not hearing is any sort of analysis of his actual time on the bench. He's on the D.C. Circuit Court, one of the most powerful courts in the country. And this claim about his partisanship has never been made. Perhaps somebody will now. Perhaps somebody will go back through some of his decisions and find it. But so far, they haven't. And I think Jeff Flake is getting at something here. Remember, Flake is one of the three Republican senators who are on the fence about Kavanaugh. None of the Democrats who are including Chris Coons, who are mentioning their concern about his temperament, were really ever going to vote for him in the first place. Will Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski, and Jeff Flake change their mind because of the angry way in which Kavanaugh responded to what he claims are smears? I don't think so. If the investigation finds out that Kavanaugh has lied about this or has lied about anything else that he's been accused of, that will change things. But the anger on display, I think, won't make a difference with the people who matter in this decision, which are those three Republican senators.
I want to take a quick call here on this point. Let's go to Rick, who's calling from Iowa City, Iowa. You're on the air, Rick. Rick, are you there?
Hello, Megan.
Hi.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Rick.
I really don't have too much faith that he will not be pushed onto the Supreme Court. So I'm going to be asking perhaps for a civic lesson. If he is appointed and confirmed, when will he have to decide how many cases he has to recuse himself because of his blast about the Kennedy or the Clintons and their conspiracy, or do the other members of the court decide when the recusal should not be used?
Right.
So,
Rick, thank you for your call. Pierre Thomas, do you want to pick up on that? Because I think if you know Judge Kavanaugh on Thursday, he talked about well-funded left-wing groups, et cetera. And if you're one of those quote-unquote left-wing groups, then you bring a case before the Supreme Court, would you be right to be concerned about Justice Kavanaugh, if he so becomes, his ability to fairly adjudicate a case like that?
You know, it's interesting. A lot of the things that were said, again, were out of anger. I think what the caller is picking up on is the invoking of the Clintons, for example, mm-hmm. that some people thought that was a bit too much. In terms of the judge and whether he recuses himself, the justices have a lot of latitude to determine what they feel like they may have a conflict of interest on. But most of the judges in many of these cases see themselves as fair arbitrators of the facts. And it's not often that they recuse themselves from cases.
All right. Well, let's go to another call here. Reggie is calling from Oskaloosa, Iowa. You're on the air, Reggie.
Yes, I was wondering if the FBI comes back and says they can find no evidence to support Dr. Ford or any of the other accusers, is a single Democrat going to change their vote? Because I think they made up their mind the day after Justice Kennedy said he was going to retire. They were voting no on whoever was nominated. And I don't even think half the Democrats in the Senate believe the charges. They just think it's a good cover because they want to vote no. Mm.
Reggie, thank you for your call. Caitlin Huey-Burns, I mean, I feel like Joe Manchin is the one Democrat
right.
name that keeps coming up.
Right. I think that we have to kind of separate out some of these red state Democrats. These are, of course, Democrats who are running for re-election this year for the Senate in states that Trump won overwhelmingly. So just given that dynamic, they often have at least an incentive politically to cross the aisle. So we've been looking at the Joe Manchin of West Virginia, Senator Joe Donnelly of Indiana, and Senator Heidi Heitkamp of North Dakota, because those are three that crossed the aisle and voted for Neil Gorsuch on the last go-round. Now, we've already heard from Senator Donnelly that he is voting no on Kavanaugh. But, of course, Joe Manchin and Heidi Heitkamp, of course, in tough reelection battles, could be some wild cards here. And they have supported the idea of going back with an FBI investigation. So there is a question of, you know, if a couple of Republican senators, if you see a Murkowski or a Collins defect and vote no, does that give political cover for those red state Democrats? Or are they going to kind of vote together on this? I think those Democrats are the ones to watch, even though many of the others have already made up their minds. What we're hearing from the offices of those Democrats in particular are that they are waiting to see what comes out of this FBI investigation.
You know, I want to talk with the three of you in a second here about what effect this the Kavanaugh nomination process is having or could have on the midterms. And Caitlin, you rightly pointed to several names and races to watch here. But I also just want to get your assessment on sort of the larger court of public opinion here. And for example, this is from CNN's State of the Union just yesterday. And White House advisor Kellyanne Conway told Jake Tapper that she, too, has experienced sexual assault.
I'm a victim of sexual assault. I don't expect Judge Kavanaugh or Jake Tapper or Jeff Flake or anybody to be held responsible for that. You have to be responsible for your own conduct. This is not Bill Cosby. Those comparisons on your network are a disgrace, and the anchor should have called them out. This is not even Bill Clinton. You have Senate Judiciary Committee members who refused to remove Bill Clinton from office after he received oral sex in the Oval Office and lied about it to a grand jury as President of the United States. The hypocrisy is ridiculous.
That's Kellyanne Conway on CNN's State of the Union just yesterday. I mean, Michael Warren, one thing that we've been hearing for days now, weeks even, ever since the allegations against Judge Kavanaugh were first surfaced, so many women from whatever party or no party at all talking about the sexual assaults they've experienced as well. And now we have Kellyanne Conway to add to that, even though, of course, she's serving as White House counsel. So politics are never far from even what she has said here. But I'm just wondering, in the broader court of public opinion regarding women and how they're reflecting on this moment, what could the effect there be on both Democrats and Republicans?
Yeah. Do you think Kellyanne's mention of Bill Clinton was a little political? I think maybe just a bit. Look, I think that the whole Me Too movement, the whole sort of movement toward exposing powerful men who have abused their positions, who have sexually abused women who work for them or under them or potentially working for them, even to going beyond abuse to assault and to rape, has been is an unalloyed good. It's been very good for society. I think what Kellyanne is trying to raise is the question of judging the cases individually. I think one of the best parts of what's happened with Me Too is the loads of evidence. A lot of it started with Harvey Weinstein. The number of specific details for specific hotel rooms, years, dates. Particular people who were seen on the way in and out of the hotel or the restaurant.
Right.
Those details have added to the sense that these men cannot run away from these accusations. And I think judging on the individual level of this is to me, and I think to a lot of Republicans, what's missing in the accusations so far against Brett Kavanaugh, which is the lack of the level of details. It doesn't mean it's not true, but it does call into question whether or not this can be compared to these other cases where there's so much more evidence and so much more that these women are able to say, this is what happened and it happened to me and nobody listened to me. Right. This is a slightly different case.
Caitlin Huey Burns, you want to chime in on this? Because, I mean, I hear what Michael's saying, but on the other hand, though, for the allegations that Professor Ford brought forward, for example, I mean, she's talking about things that she says happened to her at 15. So perhaps the level of extreme specificity on the details around the allegations aren't there yet in comparison to things that, as Michael points out with the Harvey Weinstein case, are things that happened to women when they were adults.
Right, exactly. And I think you did see the outpouring of voices after that testimony of women kind of across the country recounting things that happened to them or things that happened to their friends or family members who felt compelled to then share that information after watching Ford. You've also been hearing, though, from Republicans trying to play the other side of this, which is to say that, you know, and you heard this kind of line from Sarah Sanders, the White House press secretary, saying that, yes, I have children, I have daughters, but yes, I also have sons, and I don't want them to face, you know, false accusations, and that changed the trajectory of their lives as well. So certainly, this is all kind of coming to a head in this testimony. You had kind of a split screen on Thursday and Friday, and I think that's reflective of the split screen moment that we're in, really, in politics. And I'm curious to see kind of how this plays out, again, heading into the midterms, mm-hmm. in terms of whether this breaks down on partisan lines when we're looking at gender, how this breaks down in terms of age and so forth.
Pierre Thomas, we've got a minute to go here before the break. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I think Washington has become so polarized. And you've seen, you saw that play out last week. And here you have a situation where Dr. Blasey Ford is someone who, to many people, appeared completely credible, who said it was 100% that it was Judge Kavanaugh who attacked her many years ago. And then you had the judge who was as adamant that it did not happen. And so it's in many ways left to whatever the FBI can come up with this week to see if there's any kind of independent information that turns up that speaks to the credibility of Dr. Kavanaugh or the accusers, of Judge Kavanaugh or the accusers. And that's where we are. And remember, the FBI itself has been in the news in the middle of controversy. So this may be end up being a reflection on where are we as a country? What are the institutions that we have that still are held in high esteem that people actually believe?
Well, you're listening to Pierre Thomas. He's chief justice correspondent for ABC News. Also listening to Caitlin Huey Byrne, CBS News digital political reporter, and Michael Warren, senior writer at the Weekly Standard. And we're talking about what to look for in the week ahead. Obviously, lots of attention being paid to the FBI's background investigation of Judge Brett Kavanaugh. We'll talk more about the midterm elections coming up as well. And there's been a trade agreement, a last-minute trade agreement between the U.S. and Canada. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Seen. Listen and follow Last Seen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Caitlin Huey Byrne. She's CBS News digital political reporter. Also with Pierre Thomas, chief justice correspondent for ABC News, and Michael Warren, senior writer at The Weekly Standard. And I want to talk with all of you about the midterms here in just a second here. But Pierre, you said something before the break that I wanted to follow up on, particularly because you're justice correspondent for ABC News, about how the purpose and intent of the FBI's ongoing background investigation right now into the allegations around Judge Kavanaugh, that's supposed to provide some of the detail and clarity around these allegations that until now we possibly don't have, right? But, I mean, I just want your thoughts on this. Like, so many people over the weekend and even today are saying, how can we possibly get trustworthy clarity if the FBI isn't even investigating things like the allegations of Judge Kavanaugh's excessive drinking in college? We have multiple people coming forward saying They want to talk to the federal agents about this, but perhaps no one's reaching out to them to hear them.
Well, I guess we have to be very careful about describing what the investigation will unfold. For example, Ms. Ramirez talks about the fact of this incident happening at Yale University. So the FBI interviews her, and they get information from her regarding other people who may have known about this incident contemporaneously. So therefore, if the FBI goes and talks to those people, they may end up getting information that speaks to whether Judge Kavanaugh drank to excess, whether his demeanor changed. So that may end up in what's called the FBI 302, which is the report that they file regarding what the witnesses say. Again, the FBI will draw no conclusions about who's telling the truth or not. But what you may end up is a body of work which includes witness after witness saying the same kinds of things. And again, will that support Judge Kavanaugh's version of the story, or will it, attack that version of the story?
Well, and I mean, I'm asking you about this. I know we talked about it earlier in the show because I want to be sure we get it right. We can't be sure if the FBI would talk to those people, right? Because, there's confusion about whether or not the White House counsel's office is saying, here's the list of people you can talk to, full stop.
Right. We don't know if they have to go back to the White House and say, we've been given these additional names of people who may know specifics about this incident. Can we go talk to them? Typically, the FBI has the ability and the authority to go do that because most times the client wants to know this level of detail.
Most times.
And again, the question here, and we're tiptoeing around it, is there a conflict of interest? In this case, the White House is the client. They're directing the FBI to pursue the questions that they want answered. But at the same time, this White House has made it very clear that they want Mr. Kavanaugh approved,
right.
Confirmed.
And there's no guarantee that we will ever know who the FBI actually spoke to with certainty if the report is not made public. And if I'm remembering correctly, for example, the FBI's investigation back in 91 with Clarence Thomas, that hasn't been made public at all, right?
Well, it in theory, it will go to the White House, and then the senators, all 100, who will vote on his nomination will be able to get access to it. The question then becomes, will it leak when it gets to Capitol Hill?
Okay.
It's a little bit different era now.
Oh. so much and yet so little at the same time has changed in 1991. So let's talk a little bit about more detail about the midterms here. And in order to set that up, I just want to play actually a clip from a conversation on 60 Minutes yesterday with one man who is not running for re-election, Republican Senator Jeff Flake, because he told Scott Pelley that if he had been running for re-election, his decisions regarding delaying the vote on Brett Kavanaugh's nomination would have been very, very different.
Could you have done this if you were running for re-election?
No. Not a chance.
Not a chance.
No.
Because politics has become too sharp, too partisan?
Yeah. There's no value to reaching across the aisle. There's no currency for that anymore. There's no incentive.
Michael Warren, I'm seeing here also just a recent study from Pew that says that 76% of potential midterm voters are saying that a Supreme Court nominee or the process around it is a very important issue to them in these midterm elections. I mean, how big is this?
It is big, but I don't think we know exactly how it plays out. George Will often says that the political parties organize our animosities and that, politics is as much about who do you hate, or maybe a little nicer, who do you not like, who do you not want to see in power. Clearly, Donald Trump himself has been an organizing force for Democrats who have sort of woken up and are expecting a good election in the midterms. My question is, how many more potential Democratic voters are left to be woken up and energized to vote in the midterms? I think there is a question about whether or not enough Republicans have been energized. Mm-hmm. I don't think the Trump administration, as it's gone on, has given Republicans much to be excited about. Perhaps, and we'll have to wait to see how polling is a week or so after the hearings last week, but perhaps the feeling that Judge Kavanaugh is under siege may give Republicans a reason to get to the polls that they haven't had for the last 18 months. I don't know if that's going to be the case. We've been talking about the way that that women voters might respond. You know, anecdotally, I hear from Republican women voters who sort of take the opposite view that you might expect and say that actually Judge Kavanaugh's treatment makes them more willing to go out and vote for Republicans. We just don't know how that's going to play out. But I think an issue like this is something that does animate voters in a way that that does energize them to get out the polls in November.
Well, in fact, we heard the president himself over the weekend at those rallies galvanizing his supporters,
yes,
saying, you know, if you want to preserve the futures of judges like Judge Brett Kavanaugh, go to the polls in November. I mean, he's absolutely using it as a rallying cry. On the other hand here, look, we've got so many comments on our website. I'm seeing Yar saying that, quote, "I think we are seeing a new political party emerge, a party of women. Two different possibilities for the Kavanaugh nomination. The women of the Senate block it, or he is confirmed, and the women of the nation rally their power to throw the bums out." That is a comment on our website, onpointradio.org. Let's go to Steve, who's calling from Bangor, Maine. You're on the air, Steve.
And I would agree with that post. That is absolutely. I find it in my own, you know, all politics is local. It's a generational thing where at least social media is lit up. And I think there, females are motivated, you know. They've listened to their mothers or their grandmothers say, you know, the slogans like, "We really haven't come a long way, baby," and we haven't. This is like, we haven't changed. We still have men, mostly now in their 50s, who are making decisions, you know, on health care, pay, you know, talk about sexual assault, be in the U.S. military, and those and men still haven't done nothing because they control the military. And so I think their the bottom line is females are motivated. They're organizing. Alexandria Cortez, New York 14, that's another one that seems like, oh, that's an anomaly. You know, that can't really happen. Women can't really, you know, get out of the kitchen.
Well, Steve, you know, since you brought up the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez victory there, I want to actually take that and thank you so much for your call and turn it to Caitlin Huey Burns, because, you know, we heard Michael say earlier, just a minute or two, Michael Warren saying that, you know, he asks, and I think it's a good question, you know, how many Democratic voters are there left to be woken up for these midterms? But as the caller pointed out, there's the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez race in New York, Ayanna Pressley's victory in Massachusetts as well. I mean, both those campaigns said they won because they brought voters to the polls who had never voted before. So, you know, could the Kavanaugh stuff further galvanize those young people?
Well, I think that Michael brings up a really key point, and something, the question that I've been hearing from Republicans is, what is the ceiling of enthusiasm for Democrats? Mm-hmm. We know that it is there. We've seen it in the turnout numbers from the primaries. We've also seen in terms of women making history in terms of the number of women running for Congress. And now we're seeing it more heavily on the Democratic side than on the Republican side, but breaking some barriers here nonetheless. The question I have, too, is, you know, the president, as you mentioned, is framing this in political terms. And we know that Republicans traditionally turn out for judicial nominations, not only for the Supreme Court, but the opportunities, of course, to change judgeships across the country. That has always been a very significant idea for them. I'm wondering if that now becomes something that Democrats are galvanized around, particularly if Kavanaugh is, in fact, confirmed. And I'm also wondering, you know, I've been hearing a lot from Republicans that this could play a couple of different ways. One, if Kavanaugh does make it through, whether that leaves Republicans satisfied and they don't turn out in November, or, you know, if he's further delayed, if he is actually voted down, whether there will be such a negative reaction to Republicans in Congress. Mm-hmm. I think that's a particular dynamic to watch. But remember, the president is going to be on the road this week. He is in campaign mode, visiting a handful of red states where there are competitive Senate races. And you can imagine that he will be focusing on this throughout the week as a way to really galvanize and motivate his base, saying, as he did over the weekend, do not sit home in the midterms.
Well, Pierre Thomas, before we fully leave talking about issues related to the Justice Department, I just want to shift gears a tiny bit and get a quick take from you on what happened with Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, because last week we were just talking about how, you know, would he have a job by the end of the week? But he's still there. So what's going on?
He might be the one man in Washington who was happy that not to be, you know, on television last week. We know that he's scheduled to speak with the president in the coming days, perhaps as early as this week, to talk about his fate concerning whether he discussed invoking the 25th Amendment to remove the president of the United States from office, and whether he considered wiretapping the president or, you know, wearing a wire to go talk to the president. Early indications are, by the fact that he's still in the job, that he wants to remain in the job. And the question is, when he speaks with the president, he's denied these allegations, called them false, not accurate. The question is, will his argument convince the president that he's telling the truth?
Yeah.
And if he can do that, he probably will stay in the job at least through the midterms. If he can't, then he's in jeopardy.
All right, let's get one more call here. Paul is calling from Des Moines, Iowa. You're on the air, Paul.
Thanks. You mentioned you talking about NAFTA or the NAFTA changes, and I was just wondering from what I've heard of analysis this morning from people in the news, it's like basically just a couple little changes in NAFTA in this new trade agreement. So could your caller or could your panel talk about why all the Trump drama and everything with the tariffs and everything if we're just going to do just a couple little changes in NAFTA, basically in NAFTA?
Paul, thank you so much for your call. Michael Warren, I want to turn that to you because just to catch people up, just late yesterday, the U.S. and Canada made that last-minute agreement for a trade deal that includes Mexico. And Paul's wondering, Michael, if it's kind of not that different from what NAFTA was before.
Well, I spoke with one of my trade expert sources this morning about this, and he had the same questions. What was this all really about? This does reduce tensions with Canada, which have been high for the past several months, and perhaps Donald Trump can call it a political win. But the changes appear to be pretty minor. There's a couple of points that have been changed. But interestingly, my source pointed out to me that many of the chapters in this new NAFTA, which they're calling the USCMA or USMCA agreement, doesn't exactly roll off the tongue, would have been in place had the TPP trade plan, which of course passed Congress, was signed by getting ready to be passed by Congress under President Obama, but was scrapped. That this is essentially restoring many of the chapters that was in TPP, which President Trump ran against in his 2016 campaign. So was this all for nothing? Did it put a lot of tension with our trade partner just to the north? Perhaps it doesn't seem like we got anything out of it, although I suppose we preserved what this trade agreement, which of course has brought in so much more economic growth over the last two decades.
But Michael, I'm seeing a senior administration unnamed official telling the senior administration officials told reporters that the new agreement is, quote, a template for the Trump administration playbook for future trade deals. We got a minute to go here. So they see it as a clear victory.
Yeah. Yes. And they would, of course. And this is an argument that I've heard from free traders within the White House and Trump administration, which there are a lot of, that what this really is a negotiating tactic by the president, a gambit. It doesn't really track with Trump's own rhetoric on tariffs and on protectionism. He seems to be an actual fan of this. So the idea that this could actually preserve free trade would be sort of an interesting little political coup within the administration, even against the president's own rhetoric on this. There's one outstanding question particular to this, which is, What happens now to those steel and aluminum tariffs that the president implemented? Do those go away now? That's a question that the administration hasn't answered yet.
Caitlin Huey-Burns, last thought goes to you here. We've got about 30 seconds to go before we wrap up. We do have some new rules around North American content for cars and trucks and labor as well. So some slight changes.
Yeah, and I'm interested to see how the president talks about it this week. Remember, this is a central campaign promise and something that really galvanized those voters who weren't unique to the Republican base, but who turned out for Trump nonetheless. So he needs to have some things to be selling people. Remember, we're just a few weeks away now from people heading to the polls in November. I'm interested to see how he frames this and how Republicans in Congress respond, because remember, Congress is going to have to weigh in on this at some point.
Caitlin Huey-Burns, CBS News digital political reporter. So great to have you today. Thank you so very much.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
And Pierre Thomas, Chief Justice Correspondent for ABC News. Thank you, Pierre.
Pleasure.
Michael Warren, Senior Writer at the Weekly Standard. Great to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Magna.
Listeners, keep your comments coming on all that you hear on the show. Go to onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.